Our group has asked. Our group has asked Jessica to be our main speaker tonight.
Good evening, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jessica. I'm loud, but can everybody hear me? Even in the back? All right. So I'm going to start by telling you that I am, my sobriety date is July 9, 2002. I have worked the 12 steps with a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I do sponsor people. People sponsor me. I learn something from everybody today. That used to not be the case. You couldn't tell me nothing, and I didn't want to hear nothing. I didn't want to learn nothing new. But one day, I crossed that imaginary line. So I'll start kind of at the beginning of what it was like for me. I'm from Boston, Massachusetts. I'm biracial. My mother's white, my father's black. And I like to say this little joke because when I was young, I was not white enough or black enough, so I hung out with the Puerto Ricans. Icebreaker. That's what I did. That is the truth. And no matter who I spoke to, I took on their accent. It didn't even matter. I didn't even have to speak it. I could get a good accent like that. So I became a chameleon. My first addiction was to fantasy. I never knew that that's what it was until I heard somebody else say that. Like, I used to make believe. You know, I didn't have a father, so I used to make believe he was somebody else that was just doing something else. And then he was, you know, whatever. And my mother was this white lady who I didn't want to be my mother. I wanted anybody to be my mother but her. Anybody. And I say that because, you know, she was a single parent who always worked. And whenever she went to work, she would leave me with people to watch me. And during those times, I was getting molested, I was getting tripped, I was getting mistreated, I was getting bullied, whatever. And when she was home, she was getting beat up, bullied, mistreated, and so on. So I used to think it was her fault that she was so weak, and that she didn't teach me how to protect her. That don't make no sense. But that was my thought process, right? From very young, I was very angry, very full of rage, and I used to steal my mother's weed all the time. So, you know, I was getting kicked out of school, suspended at like fifth grade. We were filling up, back in those days, it would be thermoses with vodka and grape juice. And we would go sit out at the bleachers. This is 10 years old. 10 years old. Picture that. You know what I'm saying? I got a 12-year-old nephew. I cannot picture him doing this. I got kids that are in their 20s. I cannot picture them doing this. But me at 10 years old was sitting in the bleachers, drinking vodka in a thermos, skipping school, and that was normal. I was smoking cigarettes since I was like 7. But I come from Boston, and in the city of Boston, we're a different breed of people. We take trains by ourselves at like 8. You know, like, we're a different breed, and it was a different time. You know what I'm saying? I messed around and got old in this program. But back then, you know, I was so full of fear, but I would mask that by being angry and just being rageful and just being full of fight. You know, I had no problem with confrontation. I love confrontation. I love confrontation. And I had to practice learning to keep my mouth closed, getting sober. But moving on. When I was about 13 years old, my mother had a baby. Now, my brother and I were the only two. I was the oldest. My brother was 3 years younger. And my sister came along when I was 13 years old. And I was so mad. Like, we were good. Why did you do that? like a whoops. But, you know, today, she's like one of my best friends. I love my sister. But at that time, I was very pissed because I was like, I never could be the only kid. There was always somebody else around. And I took that to mean like I was not loved. So I was looking for love, and I was always running away from home and doing stuff. And at like 14 years old, my mother decides we're moving to Florida because she had had enough of the abuse from my stepfather. And, you know, things were just not going well for her. So we moved to Florida. I hated Florida when I got here. I mean, and we moved to Hollywood, Florida. So if anybody knows, that's not even really Florida. That's not even like any place fun. You know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't even like... And then we moved to Lake Forest. I was like, what is this? Like, what is happening? Like, why would we leave Boston to go to Lake Forest, Florida? Like, what is that, right? So whatever. So I'm mad, and I'm stealing her drinks, and I'm stealing her weed, and I'm not going to school. And I would not go to school. I would not go to school. So my mother made it a conscious decision to one day decide to pull me out of school because I wasn't going. And she was like, and I don't need the truancy officers coming here to tell me that I'm an unfit parent because you won't go to school. So she decided she was going to let me stay home and babysit my sister so she can go to work. She just needed a babysitter. That's my thinking. So now I think I'm grown. So now I start inviting people to come over and get high while she's working, and I'm supposed to be babysitting my sister. It was a disaster. I was constantly getting in jackpots. Fast forward, 21, you know, and I was escalating with the drinking. I was drinking every day. By 15 years old, I was drinking every day. You know, I had tried every other thing that you could try to go with alcohol, but alcohol was always there. By the time I was 21 years old, I was going to prison. And it was because, remember, I told you I love confrontation. I had a very bad temper and a very short fuse, and I fought everybody, everything and everyone, all the time, even my mother, even my friends. I had no friends in the end. But I went to prison, and it was for burglary battery. And burglary in the state of Florida means you enter the plane of somebody's vehicle or dwelling. I jumped in the girl's car and beat her up. That's really all I did. That's it. But because I was an alcoholic, drug addict, I could not go to probation. I would not go to probation because every time I was on my way to probation, I ran out of stuff and I had to turn around. So it never got there. So finally, they put me in, and while I'm in there, well, before I go there, I tell the judge, like, I'm not a criminal. I'm an addict and an alcoholic, and I need treatment. Because that's what I was told to say, because I didn't want to do no time, right? And the judge was like, he'd get a little chuckle, and then he said, well, I'm going to send you somewhere where you'll get plenty of treatment. The TEER program in the Department of Corrections. And that is treatment in prison. So for my time in prison, I spent time in the TEER program. And in the TEER program, they teach you about the therapeutic community. Now, I was 21 years old. I was not into or interested in a therapeutic community. All I wanted to do was be out of trouble. I didn't want to keep getting the consequences that I was getting because of my actions, because my actions kept getting me into consequences. And, you know, for every action, there's a reaction. And I could not get out of my own way to save my life. But when this happened, for the first time, I felt like I could breathe. And I don't know about anybody else, but I, to this day, believe that going to prison saved my life because I was on a very, very downward spiral. You know, I was doing everything that I could possibly do to kill myself. With alcohol and all his dry buddies, I was jumping in and out of vehicles, literally, jumping out of cars at 50 miles an hour. I was not well. And I was too young to know that I was dying. So in prison, I knew enough when I was in prison that I did not want to do any of the stuff that they did in prison to get through, you know, the hooch and whatever the heck they do in there. I was like, nah, I ain't doing that. That looks nasty. I'm not doing it. So I didn't do anything. I did try in the beginning to say that I was crazy so I could get some psychotropics. And no offense to anybody that's on psychotropics, there's nothing wrong with that if you need them. I did not need them. I was trying to be high. But when you're trying to be high and you're in orientation in prison, you're falling asleep and you got to sit on this locker all day, you're dozing off, it was very uncomfortable. So immediately I was no longer crazy. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and do this thing. So long story short, I did 4 years in prison. I got out of prison in 2000, December 12, 2000. Now, I get in and they told me to go to Little River Club. Little River Club is a little club in Miami that all the low bottoms, the lowest of the low go, like Skid Rows go there. But when I went there, I felt at home. I felt like, oh my God, my people are here. And I only said that because they had coffee, they had cigarettes, they talked plenty of shit about everybody. I was at home. Until it was time to do the meetings. When it was time to do the meetings, I was like, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to hear this. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I'm only 25 by this point. I'm too young to be an alcoholic. I was, for 4 years, I was abstinent. So I should be cured, right? Wrong. Within 2 weeks, I was back to the same thing I was doing before I left and then some more. I was finding my old people, places, and things, and I found myself getting in more hot water than I had ever been in before. And I said, whoa, something has to give because I don't want to live this life. That was the one thing that I learned when I was in prison is that I was not garbage. I was not a mistake. I was not stupid. I was not ugly because I thought I was ugly inside and out. I thought I was the worst person in the world. But coming out and being, you know, dry for a little bit and drying out, I recognized that there was some good about me, and I wanted to try to get more into that. But I didn't think I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought I would just try this myself for a change, right? So I tried this myself, and I was like, I did it for 4 years, so I should be able to do it again. Wrong. Because in there, I had people telling me what to do, when to do it, how to do it, why to do it, why not to, like, I was doing that. You know, I was doing all that. So I met up with this lady named Miss Barbara. They told me to get with Miss Barbara. Miss Barbara was this woman who was about 60-something, she was about 61, 62 years old, professional woman. She worked for the Department of Children and Families. She was very, very sophisticated. I couldn't stand her. Could not stand this lady at all. And she was just like, you're gonna drink. And I was like, I don't wanna tell you what I said, but I really was not feeling this lady, but people that were in my circle were like, she's really good and she's got a lot of time and she's gonna help you if you just let her. And I was just like, I don't like her. I am not gonna listen to somebody I don't like. So I end up asking another lady to sponsor me who was her sponsee. So inadvertently, she was still sponsoring me. Ugh. I hate when that happens in small AA communities. Everybody's related to everybody in here. So I start doing the steps. I do the steps. Got 17 months sober. I'm living it. I'm doing it. I'm miserable. Hate life. Still. White knuckling it. Pissed off. Don't know why I'm so mad. I'm dating a guy that's a normal guy who's drinking on the weekends and then goes to work like nothing happened. And I'm like, how does he do that? Like, I want to do that. So there is a clause in the big book where it says, if you think you are not an alcoholic, try some controlled drinking. Step over to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking, and stop. I did that for 14 days. Every single day for 14 days. I tried some controlled drinking. Now, let me tell you guys how progressive it is trying to be regular when you're an alcoholic. I started out with a half a pint. On day 14, I was at a half a gallon. I had progressed in 2 weeks, and I'm talking about straight liquor. I never drank like that before, but I was drinking like that now, trying to be normal, trying to be something that I wasn't. And in the end, I ended up doing exactly what I was gonna do anyway, and that was to go over to the neighborhood dope boy, because that's what I did when I drank. I was trying to keep drinking. And after 17 months, and how it started was like, I went to the liquor store and it was pouring rain outside. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I went and I bought this bottle and I'm crying, holding this bottle going, no, you don't. Yeah, you do. No, you don't. Yeah, you do. No, you don't. Yeah, you do. And the bottle won. Why? Because I did not have a contact. I had no power. I really didn't have a belief. I believed that there was a higher power. I was not an atheist, but I did not believe that that higher power was doing anything for me because of all I had done in my past. I thought that because of the person I used to be, he couldn't possibly hear me today. I never even asked him to help me. So now, at day 14, funny story, I'm trying to get more money out of my then boyfriend. I was like, I just need $20. He was like, for what? I was like, my headlight went out. I tried the old headlight trick and it worked. But the kicker to that is that you actually got to get the headlight fixed. And when I came home $20 later and the headlight was still broke, he was like, and then that was it. That was when the moment of clarity hit. That I had done something. I had hurt someone else who had done nothing but help me. He is the one who put money on my books in prison. He was the one who stayed by my side. When I was scared in there, he would tell me to read Psalm 91. I didn't know nothing about the Bible. I didn't know nothing about nothing. But I would pray, and he would pray with me. And I was not for him. I was all back into self. I was all back into what I wanted, how I wanted, why I wanted, when I wanted, if I wanted. So the moment happened. Now, during the 14 days of my drinking, I was doing the controlled drinking. But remember, I had done 17 months in AA, so I knew a few people. And there was this one girl who kept calling me every day, and she was just calling to check on me. And she never told me to stop drinking. She never told me I needed to go to the meeting. She never said anything. She would call every day and she would say, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay? You good? You good? And I would just, yeah. So on that day, when that fateful moment happened and I realized that something had to give, something really had to change because I was going completely out of my mind, I called her and I said, I need help. And she said, I'm on my way. And she picked me up because I had a car. Remember that car that didn't have, that had the broken headlight. And I had $10 left in my pocket, but I didn't trust myself to get there. If I got in my car, I couldn't tell you if I was going to get to the meeting or if I was going to go left. Because 9 times out of 10, I went left. I never could trust myself once I started. I couldn't stop and I couldn't trust myself to do anything right after that. So we went to the meeting, and for the first time, like, something shifted. And I think it was because I finally understood what it meant to give up this gift, to give up the gift of sobriety. Like, I was free and I didn't even know it. I was living the dream that I always wanted, was to be normal and to do things healthy, and I was spitting it. I was spitting at it. I didn't want it. I wanted the old life because that's what I was used to. And remember, guys, even though poop is warm, it still stinks. It's familiar, though. So even if it stinks, we know it. You know, we know it's going to stink, but it feels good when we're in it in the moment until it stops being warm. Then it just stinks, and I'm now poopy. So now I have to figure out what next. So I go to the meeting and I'm crying in the front of the meeting because I was taught that you go sit in the front. My sponsor told me the one I couldn't stand was like, you were there from prayer to prayer. You can smoke your cigarette before you get in there, and you can wait till after the meeting to smoke another cigarette. You don't need to be getting up in the middle of the meeting to go smoke no cigarette. Like, oh, I couldn't stand that lady. But I stayed, and I sat in the front, and I focused on the speaker, and all I could do was cry. And it reminded me of the first time I ever went to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I was in my jail cell, and I wanted to get out the cell. I didn't know nothing about AA then either, but I wanted to get out the cell, and this lady started talking to me, and she was telling my story, and all I could do was cry. So I was back in that moment. Fast forward to that day, July 9th, 2002, I'm sitting in the front, right where that lady's sitting, as a matter of fact, second from the right, and I'm just bawling and listening to this lady speak, and it hit me that I have never conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, and that anytime I put alcohol in my body of any kind, I no longer had the power to choose. Holy crap, what a conundrum. Because let me tell you something, to not have the ability to choose, I don't ever want to feel that again. I don't ever want to not be able to choose what happens to me intentionally, because I was doing it to myself. Nobody was doing it to me. So from that day to this one, I had to get a new sponsor, because when I went back to the sponsor that had taken me through the steps prior, she goes, I gave you everything I could. I can't do nothing else for you. So I went 5 months without a sponsor, but I went to meetings every day. And I had remembered this beautiful woman who was in the meeting speaking the day before I drank. And I was mad. And she gave me the best hug I ever had in my life. And that was when I became a hugger. Because I didn't hug you people, I didn't touch your hands, I did not want to hold your hand, do not touch me, I don't want to be your friend. I was like that, I was so ugly, I was such a bitch. But, oh my God, I was horrible, I couldn't stand myself. But from that moment, I remember I was 5 months sober, and there was a three-quarter way house for women, and it was called The Turning Point. And I was going to that meeting, and it happened to be her 5-year anniversary that day, and she was speaking. And she gave such a speech that I was like in awe of her. I didn't move. I felt like I was freeze frame. Like I couldn't move. All I could do was just watch her mouth. It was crazy. But after that, I walked up to her and I was like, can you be my sponsor? And she was like, well, what do you want in a sponsor? And I was like, I don't know, I just want what you have. And she said, well, do you pray? I lied. Yes, I pray. Of course I do. She said, all right, what time you get up in the morning? And at the time, I was an IHOP waitress, so I got up very early. And she says, well, when you get up in the morning, I want you to pray. And then call me at 6 in the morning. 6 in the morning. I did that. I called her after I prayed. For the first time I prayed, and this was my prayer. I don't know if you're real, but if you are, please help me. That was my prayer. She started sponsoring me. We went through the big book. We started at the preface. We worked through all those pages all the way to the back. We did the 12 and 12 the same way, 12 by 12, 12, whatever. We did the 12 and 12 all the way through. From the traditions, from the steps to the traditions. And after my fifth step, she goes, well, you can sponsor. I was like, I'm never going to sponsor anybody ever. Not happening. I don't have anything anybody wants. She goes, of course you do. Of course you do. You almost died out there, but you're here. And I always get a little choked up because she loved me so much, and she still loves me. She's still my sponsor today. That's Big Mama. And Big Mama loved me so much. She was like, baby girl, if you don't go and love on somebody and give back what was given to you, you're going to shrivel up. I was like, I'm going what? You're going to shrivel up. You've got too much love to give to just be selfish. So I started sponsoring people. And my very first sponsee was a nightmare. Nightmare. But it kept me sober. She didn't stay for long. Then I saw her 10 years later. I was like, I thought you died, girl. And she was like, I almost did, but I didn't. And she stayed sober like 12 years and went out. And then I thought she was dead last year. And I just saw her right when I was in Miami the other day. My very first sponsee. I love her to death. But I stayed sober through all the nightmares. I was a three-quarter warehouse manager. Nightmare. Sorry, guys. Any of you in a three-quarter house, I'm sorry, but y'all are nightmares in the beginning. Nobody wants to pay their rent. Everybody's late. Nobody wants to come to the house meetings. It's like a nightmare. But I would call my sponsor. She's like, did you drink? I'm like, oh, this woman, what's wrong with her? But I understood it was all about giving it back. Like, I learned so much being here. It was the first time that women, because I didn't do women because y'all couldn't do nothing for me. I couldn't manipulate you out of anything, so I didn't need you for nothing, right? Because only the guys, I could get what I wanted from the guys, and my sponsor was like, you're on a man ban. It's like, what the hell, a man ban? Yeah, girl. Yeah, guys, I was on a man ban because I was too manipulative. So she was like, you're not allowed to be around no guys, period. I was like, whatever, I'll figure it out. But in doing all that, I learned that, you know, it's about putting God in the place of everything that I had loved before. And I'm not a religious person by any stretch, but I do have a conscious contact because I was powerless. I had no power. I finally came to believe that there was a power. I made a decision to trust this process and continue on with this process. I did a fearless and moral inventory. I shared it with God and another human being. I actually was entirely ready to have him remove these defects because I'm a hot mess. I needed to be rid of some of this stuff. But some of the stuff I held on to. And my sponsor told me, guess what, girl? You're going to hold on to it until it gets too hot to hold. You're going to get tired of feeling the way you feel, and you're going to let it go. But not until you're ready. And nobody can make you be ready, just like nobody can make you get sober. And that happened. But every day, I humbly asked him, and I humbly asked him, and I humbly asked him, and then it got me ready to make that list. Made the list. Was it really necessarily the list from step four like they talk about? Because that was a whole other list. This list was the get real list. What'd you do to somebody? You know, so my sponsor helped me with the direct, indirect, partial. You know, direct was right now, immediate. Indirect was those, you know, we ain't gonna go to the dope boy's ex-wife who he stole the money from to give to me. Like, I wasn't doing that. So I was gonna do the next right thing and live better. I was gonna help. I was gonna donate. I was gonna make sure I put something in the basket every time it came around my lap. And then the partial, except when to do so would injure them or others. That means you do not hurt nobody else for your gain. I learned that here. I didn't know that before. I didn't give a shit. I know it now, and I teach it now, and that's we live by that today. We don't hurt nobody for our own personal gain. And then 10, my girl's husband, it goes round and round, 10, 11, 12, 10, 11, 12. 1 through 9 is linear, 10, 11, 12. And I love that. I got to thank him again because it's true. It's ongoing. 10, 11, 12 is ongoing, and they all intertwine with each other. There is no one without the other, you know? And obviously, we know that 12 is what I'm doing here today, you know? I'm here carrying a message. I'm trying to carry the message. So if you didn't get anything else out of what I had to say today, know that you gotta trust in a power greater than yourself. It has to be bigger than your alcoholism. Like, my sponsor told me it had to be bigger. It had to be, and she said, my power is so big that even the devil gotta ask permission. And I said, I want that. It had to be bigger than the alcohol, it had to be bigger than the dope, it had to be bigger than the men, it had to be bigger than the money, it had to be bigger than all of that. Because I idolized a lot of stuff. I wanted stuff. And nothing could fill the void that was inside of me. Nothing could fill me. I was so empty until I found that power. And on days, even days when I feel like crap, and there are days, because I've had years that sucked. I've been married in this program. I've been divorced in this program. I've been remarried. I've been through. You know, I didn't never give birth to kids, but I got sober. And let me tell you what God did, y'all. God hooked me up with this man that had four kids. He was a single father with four kids who lived with him full time. And me, I'm in love. I love him so much. I married this man and I raised these kids and I don't think I could do it again. But at the time, I did it and I was so grateful to do it because God gave me kids. Because I was so abusive to myself, I could not have children. But God blessed me anyway. He said, I'm going to bless you. And he gave me beautiful children. They're all pain in my butt, but they're beautiful. And now I got grandbaby, my first grandbaby. And I am, like, so grateful.
Thank you.
I'm so grateful that I would have missed that. I would have missed that. If I was sitting in myself, in my poop, like I like to be, warm and cozy in my poop, I would have missed it. Yeah, because that's what we do. We sit in our shit. Like, don't get it twisted. That's what we do. I know for me, I want to sit in it until I can't stand the smell. Because that's what makes me change. I say this often, and my husband tried to steal it. The pain got to be greater than the fear of change. I'm going to say that again. The pain has to be greater than the fear of change. Like, I had to be in so much pain, like, there was nothing else. I had to face what was happening. I had to deal with, that's what made me change. That's a great motivator. When I don't have pain or consequences, there ain't no reason to change it. Amen? But guess what? When the pain is great, okay, I give. I don't want to be homeless again. I don't want to prostitute my body again. I don't want to be in abandoned buildings trying to figure out where the heat is going to come from. Because I was doing that for no reason. I had a mother who had a house and I had my own bedroom and I just would not go there because I wanted to be homeless. Because I was with a man that didn't have no job. But he was fine. And he would get me alcohol and he would get me other stuff. So I fell for the okie doke when I was young. Thank God for young people meeting. Y'all get in here young. Wrap them in. Get in here young. Don't be young dummies. Get in here. Because if you don't get in here young, you become old dummies. And you come in old and dumb. So we gotta come in here young and get smart. Figure out that this is where we need to be. Like, God is so good, and I'm so grateful that I was here. I know I tried to make it funny, but this is life or death, guys. This is so serious. It wasn't always funny, especially when I was jumping out of that car at 50 miles an hour, lost a shoe and everything. The shit was not funny at the time. Now I can laugh. Like, damn, I like that shoe, but, like, that shit was serious. And I'm jumping out of vehicles. Why? Going to jail, getting arrested, going to prison. Like, what? Me going to prison? Can anybody see me in prison? I was there for years because of this disease. Because I couldn't get out of my own way to understand that I didn't belong in a place like that. I don't belong out there. None of us do. But sometimes we have to go through the valley to get to the peaks. Trust God, clean house, help others. Thank you.